Blog Talk Radio.
Here we go. With that, we are off and running. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Drive Through HR and making it a part of your day. We have a wonderful guest, and Nisha and I are fortunate to have someone smarter than probably the two of us combined. Kind of break some things down, talk a lot, and kind of educate our audience. So without any further ado, Tomas, how are you doing today?
I'm fine. Hi, guys. Smarter than you individually, but not combined.
Nice. Well, you never know. You just never know these days. First of all, before we get to what's keeping you up at night, do us a favor and introduce yourself to the audience. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yes, sure. I'm a personality psychologist who spent most of his time in Europe and is now in the U.S. and about understanding individuals at work and the widest possible range of meanings. So how can we leverage everything we know on the psychology of people to make organizations more effective and to make people happier at work? And this, you guys are going to discuss innovation today.
Awesome. Well, tell us what's keeping you up at night and or your clients up at night.
Yeah, so, and I mean, it's keeping me up at night. That's the easier answer. I sleep really well, and I wake up excited about possibilities and opportunities, but nothing keeps me up. My clients, on the other hand, I think are concerned or worried about the changes that are witnessing in the HR industry, I think, because I see them as having trained in certain skills, which and that are soon becoming very outdated or obsolete. And in a way, going back to the first bit of what keeps excited, not that thing, you know, we have seen in pretty much all industries a change from B2B business model to B2C. It's happened to the music industry. It happened to the film industry. It happened to, the travel industry, hotels, hospitality, etc. It hasn't yet quite reached the level that I would expect it to reach of careers and work. This awake plans of mine are happening. And I guess
hey Tomas, I think your cell phone is breaking up. Do us a favor, call, just hang up and call right back in. Maybe we'll get a better connection, and Nisha and I will hold down the fort while you're doing that. Nisha, we're going to dig into personality. So have you used personality assessments in the past? And in all of your kind of travels, have you ever used any of the types of applications out there that kind of give you insight into personality?
Well, while I was working in my previous company and with aligned to the leadership programs, we did use personality assessments for deciding, you know, the succession planning and what are some personalities that we have seen can be the next leaders and can be promoted for the, you know, next positions and all. So, yes, as from an organizational point of view, yes, we did use it. But I'm kind of interested in knowing more about what are some personalities of innovators.
Well, see, I... You know, I think personality can inform almost everything in HR, from comp to performance to succession to high potentials to everything. But I don't think we use the data. Like I think we have data around personality. Maybe we don't have the right data, but I don't think we think that personality is that important. So Tomas, I see that you've joined us again. Let's check your sound quality. How are you doing?
Yes, good. Sorry, guys, I cut off.
No. How do you? Let's bring it back to you and your expertise in personality for just a second. What do you think we go wrong in personality? Like how? Why isn't it more talked about? Why don't we leverage it more?
I think the main problem is that everybody talks about it so much that the popular interest on personality actually threatens serious practice. You know, if you look at things like BuzzFeed, which on a daily basis releases hundreds of quizzes that are completed by people worldwide because they want to know what their ideal city is, what their, what they would be in their next life, or who they would be if they were a philosopher. You know, there's a lot of interest in understanding ourselves and other people. However, because most of these tests or tools are popular and inaccurate, they kind of lead people to conclude that this isn't a serious science, that there isn't a serious, robust, accurate scientific method to personality profiling. And so, in a way, we need to re-educate the market.
That's great, Thomas. Well, William and I were talking in the beginning, like, you know, does this personality determine leadership abilities? When we talk about, you know, succession planning or any sort of promotions that are happening in any organization, do you think that, okay, this personality test should be a key factor in determining the leadership abilities of the person who is going to get succeeded?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's important to be aware or state at the outset that, you know, predict with 100% of accuracy who will be a good leader. However, within the realm of what's feasible, you know, accounting for all the eventualities and serendipities that we will never be able to predict, personality is the most of leadership performance. Who you are determines how you lead, and that's true for sports, for education, for corporate America. If you examine any bunch of people who are led or managed by somebody, the characteristics, the psychological characteristics, their interests, style, and values of that person will be the most important single factor of how the group performs.
That's true. So what's the role of this work culture or the work environment per se? Because you know what we have seen is every personality won't survive in every culture, right?
Right. So, you know, culture is incredibly important because it determines whether the manager or the leader will fit in with his or her skill sets, whether he or she will be happy, and then whether individual employees will be able to fulfill their needs in that environment. Important to understand is that culture is not something that happens independently of leadership. Leaders create the culture of an organization. This happens over time, sometimes over years or decades, so it's hard to measure these things in real time. But even if you look at old organizations and you try to understand or assess their culture, their legacy, their cultural legacy is still a function of the vision of the early founders. So, and at the same time, new leaders can transform that culture and create a new climate for employees in which they will thrive or be unhappy.
That's great. So can we, you know, train or sort of mold, you know, a person's character and create a personality? Or probably can we tweak somebody's personality in order to match to the culture of the organization? Do you think so?
You could, but it would require so much work and time, and the effectiveness of such interventions will be so low, the efficacy, that you're better off just finding the right people. You know, and the reason is that people tend to become exaggerated versions of themselves. So they will be happier themselves if they are in environments that are congruent or consistent with the personality, so that they can become like an exaggerated version of themselves rather than having to force themselves to do something that goes against their natural nature or tendencies. So it goes to say that for both for the employer and the employee, it's important to just understand or diagnose fit as opposed to trying to force somebody to fit into an incompatible environment.
That's great. So we normally talk to almost, you know, people who are coming from HR or recruiting background. We almost ask the same question. But then it is so fascinating to hear, you know, different responses from them when it comes to when they were to select, you know, competency versus culture fit. So what is going to be the primary factor when you bring in some new resources or new employee to an organization?
Right. So, you know, I think whether you talk about it in terms of competencies, talent, personality, I mean, personality is probably the most academic and the most questionable or controversial of terms. But at the end of the day, all these efforts, all these concepts have the same goal, share the same goal, which is, they're based on the same assumption, right? People are different. Everybody is different, and people are individuals because they are unique. And so how can we understand what these different people or individualities are like in order to first predict what people are likely to do in different environments, and then in order to also try to shape or influence their behavior? So the first part is what concerns selection, and the second part is what concerns developing individuals, you know. But if you're incapable of understanding people, or you assume that everybody is the same, or that everybody will automatically behave in a way that their environment leads them to behave, you're going to have a big problem. I mean, you're going to be surprised by what people do, and people are going to be, first, unhappy, and secondly, not performing to the best of their capabilities.
What do you think we can do with teams in terms of organizing teams and personalities that fit better or might not fit better? And again, separate the myths from what you know is the reality. Do you think we should use personality to organize teams?
Yes, absolutely. First, because and here we need to understand personality in its broadest sense, not just when it comes to understanding what somebody's style or typical patterns of behaviors are, but also what their values and drivers are. And, you know, it is a well-established fact that if you want to have, build, or create high-performing teams, they need to be highly compatible, congruent, and homogeneous when it comes to their values. They need to have the same interests and drivers. Okay. However, at the same time, you need to have diversity in terms of their competencies, their strengths, their skills, and that's a generalization that holds true everywhere. You know, people get along with others who are similar to themselves in terms of their views of the world, their attitudes, and their values. But in order to work together as a team, and if you're expecting a synergy that leverages their individual skill set, they need to be different. And I think, you know, sports is the best example of how this comes into play or comes into action. You know, the most successful sporting teams are motivated and driven by the same agenda, by the same attitudes and views, but they have players who are completely different in terms of their styles, strengths, and, you know, skills.
So one of the things about personality, I want you to kind of help shine a light on really the assessment industry in general, but more specifically the personalities, is that you can go from a place of not knowing to knowing. So you didn't know what your personalities, let's say you have a, you know, 1,000 people and you didn't know their personalities before, and then you assess for that, and now you know. Well, what do you do with that? Like, what's the action layer after you know, now what?
Yeah, so good question, you know, and that's what separates the science of diagnosis from the art of management. I think we have incredibly accurate and well-crafted tools for diagnosis, the only thing that the diagnostic tools tell us is what these different people, what these 1,000 people are likely to do in the same or different situations. But what you do after that, you know, depends on your vision, on your plans, on your strategy. Certainly, I would definitely advise, if you're using this for recruitment, go with the profile information and say, well, if I need somebody who needs to work in a very interpersonal role, let's go for people who are more sociable, more extroverted, more charismatic, if you like. But then what do you do when you need to modify or influence the behavior of these people later on so that they behave in a certain way or another? Well, personality also holds the key to how you motivate people. Okay, if you have a comprehensive profile of a person or these 1,000 people, you will know not just how they're likely to behave with others, but what's likely to drive them. You know, to give you a crude example, some people are much more driven by commercial incentives than others. Others need recognition. Others need to have fun at work. So having a robust profile of your employees, prospective or current employees, is something that you should always go back to when you're relating to employees, just because it will reemphasize over and over again that people are different and you should treat them in a different way. Any manager who assumes that they have found a standard way of operating, of treating employees, will be doomed, because people expect different treatment. You motivate people according to their personalities.
All right, we got to pivot to innovation, because to have you on the show and not talk about innovation is a little silly. So how do you think that HR and recruiting, you know, what are some of the great examples that you see where people are making innovative strides?
I think that they are making, in the industry, the most innovative strides, I think, have to do with the consumerization of recruitment in the field. You know, this interface now between marketing and even branding and recruitment, the fact that a lot of companies are successfully releasing or developing tools that are at the same time marketing devices and also talent acquisition tools. And this is what some people refer to as the consumerization of personality tests. I mean, now so many people have data on consumers. And, you know, if you think about it, consumers or prospective employees have the same personality profile. We all have a profile now from using the internet, whether it's because we book certain trips, we stay in hotels, we listen to certain music. And to the extent that all that data or these data can be aggregated to accurately profile our style, our interests, that's going to be useful in HR and for talent acquisition. And nobody has fully cracked this yet, but I think data integration as a way to profile prospective employees is the most exciting thing we're seeing now.
That's great. So what it really means to have a culture of innovation at workplace? Because we always talk about, hey, our work culture is so innovative, but yet when it comes to, you know, letting the organization know what it means to have a culture of innovation in that, people really miss the mark.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, the first problem is that most organizations think they're a lot more innovative than they actually are. So it's important to have a robust diagnostic tool in place to show organizations, enable them to benchmark themselves against their competitors and say, well, look, if you are senior management, you think you're really innovative. When we ask your employees, they all feel that their work consists of routine habits and that they are not being asked to innovate. In fact, the opposite, that if they do something unexpected, they are punished. Okay, so first, a reality check for companies so they actually understand what their culture is. And secondly, I think, you know, companies face the innovator's paradox or dilemma, whereby if you have a small business, innovation will lead to growth. But as businesses grow, growth hinders innovation. So the key challenge is how can organizations keep being innovative despite or in spite of their success? And, you know, if you're doing something that works, it's very easy to build a business or focus resources around that, but that will sooner or later make you stagnate and less innovative. So I think the answer to this is, again, recruiting the right people. And organizations that get this right are trying to hire people who are like the traditional entrepreneurs. You know, they hire people without giving them a specific job or without having a specific role in mind. They just give them resources and ask them to disrupt systems and processes that are actually being very successful and working within that company and within that culture. So hire people who are disruptors, who are a little bit antisocial, who have problems with authority, give them resources and freedom, and encourage them to fail, and you will maintain an innovative culture.
Great. So, Thomas, I mean, you know, when we talk about organizations, I've heard that, you know, apart from this work culture, even organization has its own personality. So what do you think are the traits of organizations who are innovators?
Really interesting question. And, you know, it's a tricky question because you can't just aggregate all the personality of the employees or even managers to arrive to the personality of the organization, okay? But I think that there are certain values that make up the DNA of innovative organizations. And I think they tend to be very fluid or flexible as opposed to bureaucratic. So they decentralize decision-making power and empower people to make their own decision at all levels. So they tend to be flat more than hierarchical as well. And fundamentally, they're non-traditional or non-conservative, you know. So in a way, what's interesting or paradoxical about these organizations is that they don't really have a well-defined culture. They don't have a legacy that pushes them automatically to default on, this is how we have done things so far, so let's keep doing this. So if you saw them or you compared them to a person, they will be actually difficult individuals. They will be unpredictable, they will be moody and irritable, and they will be very hard to manage. Okay, so this is where the challenge comes as well. But there is a fundamental difference between organizations that are creative or creative individuals and the leaders or managers who need to manage or facilitate that process. This is why there is a lot of data showing that organizations or startups perform better if the founders remove themselves from the CEO role and hire people who let's say, are less antisocial and more stable from an emotional or psychological point of view.
So a question that's two ways. When do you know you're being innovative? And so that's one part of it. And the second part of it is there a diminished return on innovation?
Mm-hmm. So you only know when other people tell you. You don't know for sure when you think you're being innovative. You know, most people self-evaluate their innovation output in a much more generous and lenient way than others do, okay? So in other words, of all the people who think they're being innovative, probably just 10 or 20% actually are contributing to innovation or having a creative impact. And is there a diminished return? You know, in the long run, no. In the short run, yes. It's a little bit like discussing or talking about the tension between short-term gains and vis-a-vis long-term rewards. I think innovation, proper disruptive, groundbreaking innovation, it pays off in the long run. And, sometimes investing in it or doing what you need to do to achieve that also means or requires you to not pay attention to or to sacrifice short-term gains. So, but the disadvantages of the drawbacks would be that. In the long run, if you're doing something innovative, you will succeed.
All right, so we'd be remiss in the last 5 minutes if we didn't talk about the World Cup. And, it's coming. It's 100 days from now. And as we evaluate this wonderful collection of these teams, what are you most excited about? Not just the football that we're going to all get to witness, but just from a talent perspective, the people, human talent stuff that we all love. When you look at this great stage, what's exciting to you about the World Cup?
Well, I mean, firstly, I have to make the comment that as an Argentine or Argentinian, I'm incredibly afraid of another World Cup going to Brazil. So that's what's keeping me up at night. You know, over the past 6 or 7 World Cups, my only moments of joy consisted of Brazil being eliminated. And then you have the whole world wanting Brazil to win. So it's very tedious for myself. From the point of view of talent at the individual and teams levels and the actual event, I think it's very exciting. It's very exciting that the World Cup of the most popular sport is played in the place where people are craziest about it. And at the same time, from a talent point of view, we have almost every single big talent, big name will be there, except Ibrahimovic, of course, but everybody else will be there. I think it will be an amazing spectacle and a great World Cup. There are 4 teams clearly that are favorites: Brazil, Germany, Spain, and Argentina. But predictions are almost always inaccurate when it comes to sports. I think because all these forces interact, there's management, there's individual talent, and team performance as well. And all I can hope is that Messi arrives there in good shape.
Yeah. How do you think behind the veil, how do you get this talent? Because all these guys are on all kinds of different clubs. It's not like they all play together. They come together periodically and play. How do you harness, I mean, just because you have the greatest players on a particular, country's team, it doesn't mean that they bode well. It doesn't mean that they do well in a tournament like this. How do you think behind the veil that they get these personalities to have a shared vision?
I think precisely because they have, or they are benefiting from the legacy of great historical leadership. If you look at places like Barcelona, where everybody who has played there for the past 15 or 20 years shares the same values, came from the same academy, and no matter how good they are, they understand that 2 things are more important than themselves, which is the performance of the team and the performance of the club, or the happiness of the club. And that's what's really difficult to achieve now at the level of national teams, because you get a bunch of players who have spent most of their time far away from each other, playing in different countries, making a lot of money playing for different clubs, and suddenly they're asked to form a team and play for each other for the love that they might have to their country of origin. And that's difficult. That's not easily achieved, especially when you have managers that have been brought in for this occasion at a very short-term basis, on a short-term basis, and who have different philosophies, different aspirations, and different plans. So the only country that has managed to do this historically is Germany. You know, you have players who play individually in different places, but when they put on the German T-shirt of the national team, they perform as if their life was at stake and dependent on it. So they really feel the passion of all the people there. Otherwise, most of other players behave like mercenaries who have to be there and who are in the World Cup just to increase their valuation, and that's all they want to get out of it.
Yeah, I'm most interested to see how the Pope handles all this, because he's got a very interesting take, because obviously of his country of origin, but also in what the Catholic Church would like to do in Brazil. So we'll see. We'll be watching the Pope, see how he plays out. But listen, we're out of time. I want to thank everyone for listening to Drive Through HR. Tomas, thank you for dropping knowledge. Everyone, have a wonderful afternoon, and thank you again for listening to Drive Through HR. We're going to go out to a little Cure.